I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. It's Defenders Day, when Marylanders celebrate the successful defense of Baltimore during the War of 1812. Today, a conversation about Baltimore's history, from the Revolution in the 18th century to the uprising in the 21st. My guest is the renowned political scientist Matthew Crenson of Johns Hopkins University. His latest book examines the political, economic, geographic, and cultural factors that have shaped Baltimore's rise from a colonial afterthought to one of America's most eclectic and eccentric cities. Baltimore, a political history. We'll talk about it when Midday gets underway, right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, a conversation about Baltimore. People call it different things, charm city or mob town, the city that reads or the city that bleeds. But whatever you call it, Baltimore holds an important place in the hearts of most of the folks who live here. Our town, like many American cities, is a place of contradictions. We are home to some of the best medical centers in the country. Yet there is a 10 or 12-year difference in life expectancy from one neighborhood to another. We have a vibrant creative community that helps us maintain a solid reputation as quirky and eclectic, and an inferiority complex that has us question our worth relative to places like Boston or Philadelphia. Baltimore is smaller, more affordable, and more intimate than New York, but our murder rate per 100,000 people is 10 times that of our northern counterpart. Multi-million-dollar homes in the Inner Harbor and Guilford are within walking distance of streets that have more boarded-up homes than occupied ones. There are many reasons for these disparities, and as a new book by an eminent political scientist makes clear, there are ample historical precedents for our current predicaments. Matthew Crenson is my guest today. He's a professor emeritus of political science at Johns Hopkins University. His new book traces the development of Baltimore from colonial times through the present day. It's called Baltimore, A Political History. Matt Crenson, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
You are welcome to join our conversation about Baltimore. 410-662-8780. That's the number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, right in the prologue, you write about the personality of Baltimore. And I wonder, is there really such thing as a personality of a city?
I think there is. It's an idea, at least, that has a long lineage. Over 100 years ago, a man named Ed Hungerford wrote a book called The Personality of American Cities. He also wrote a two-volume history of the B&O Railroad. And although he wasn't born in Baltimore, he had strong ties here. And I think that may have given him his idea for the book. And today, people go online to find out whether their personality matches up with the personality of any city. Huh. And, of course, there's a writer named Richard Florida.
You can Google that.
That's right. Well, I did. Yeah. I found out that I'm supposed to be in Boston. and the funny thing is that I did live across the Charles River from Boston for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And my personality and Boston's personality were definitely incompatible.
There you go. Well, sometimes the apps get it wrong. I mean, you know, in 1790, a date that we just sort of pick out of nowhere, Baltimore was the fourth largest city in the United States.
13,000 people.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right now, Houston's the fourth largest city, and we are the 26th city, largest in terms of population.
Right.
Memphis, Boston, Nashville are right above us. But how different do you think Baltimore really is from the similarly sized cities that you mentioned, like Milwaukee, Denver, Oklahoma City?
Mm-hmm.
I've worked in all those places. They don't seem that
well. I talk about it in the book. One indicator of just how distinctive Baltimore is. I picked out those cities from the highest source of scholarly authority, named Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And if you write it, put in the name of any major American city, Wikipedia will give you an entry that includes the list of the city's neighborhoods. So I picked a bunch of cities in different parts of the country that had roughly the same population as Baltimore, and then went around counting neighborhoods. So Boston, according to Wikipedia, has 105 neighborhoods. Milwaukee has 50. Memphis has 70. Oklahoma City has 25. Denver has 78. Baltimore, 300.
Yeah, 300. And the, again, same, roughly the same
roughly
number
the
of
same
people,
population.
But divided up into 300 little enclaves.
Even Chicago, with three times the land area and four times the population of Baltimore, has only 245 neighborhoods.
Right. And sometimes the, people call Chicago the city of neighborhoods.
We're even more so.
Yeah. Do you think that fact, that we have divided ourselves up in so many little, teeny little groups, it's like, you know, tables in the lunchroom in high school, has that contributed to the racial disparity and the racial separation and inequality of our city?
I think it has, unquestionably. We've been sliced and diced into so many little parcels that we're able to separate ourselves from one another and develop a host of eccentric cultures. Years ago, I wrote another book about Baltimore. This is back in 1983, where I interviewed 1,700 residents in 21 different neighborhoods. And I used all the factors that tend to sift people out into neighborhoods. And then I put in one other factor. There's a statistical time in my life. One other factor, the neighborhood that they lived in. And I found out that in many cases, for their attitudes, their behavior, the simple fact they lived in a certain neighborhood was more important, more powerful than class, race, education, any of those other things. So neighborhood culture is really powerful.
More powerful in what way? To them personally?
If you look at their attitudes, for example, what they think about the neighborhood, what they think about the city, what they think about their neighbors, the neighborhood where they live explains more of the variability in many of those things than all their personal characteristics put together.
Do people... do you think tend to say where they're from, not from Baltimore, but from, you know, I'm from Oliver, I'm from Eastside, I'm from, you know, Arlen Park?
They do. And, of course, the other big identifying characteristic in Baltimore is where you went to high school.
Right.
Because that tells people roughly what kind of cultural niche you fit into.
Right. The kid that goes to Gilman is a different, you know, person from the kid who goes to City or the kid that goes to Dunbar or something. Yeah. It's fascinating to think about the lineage, and you make the point that there is a lineage between the problems that our city encountered as it, you know, developed from the 1700s through the present. I thought in particular about the violence that we're experiencing now. Baltimore has been a rough town for a long time. It earned the sobriquet mob town pretty early on.
Probably more than 200 years ago, although it wasn't called mob town in those days. The problem for Baltimore was that at the very beginning, the provincial assembly, the ancestor of the state legislature, gave the government of Baltimore hardly any power to govern. The town commissioners, who were appointed and served for life, were not elected, had the power to lay out the city. That was it. So when other essential services were needed, the citizens had to improvise them. They would occasionally gather outside the courthouse and deliberate about what was essentially public policy. And then, because they had no official authority, they would enforce those public policies with their fists or wooden clubs or whatever else came to hand. So the seeds of mob town are buried very deeply in our history. And I'm talking about around the time of the American Revolution.
Yeah. I mean, we of course, had this horrible violence 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, in April of 2015. In 1835 alone... there were 147 riots in our city in that 1 year.
And
I mean, riots were like an everyday occurrence.
They were, and especially around election time. That's when riots multiplied. In one election in 1856, 30 people were killed and hundreds injured. The rioters, the gangs, sometimes brought out small artillery pieces to shoot at one another. We know things are bad now. Maybe they were a little better then, but not by much. And I don't think I'd want to live in Baltimore back then.
And that kind of violence, it was less usual, unusual in places like Philly, Boston, D.C., New York?
There were riots in 19th century cities all over the place. You had the draft riots in New York, for example, in 1863. Rioting was a common activity. But Baltimore riots were different. Baltimore, for example, had a riot in 1812. where there were fatalities. That's been written about as the riot that broke the Anglo-American riot tradition, because traditionally rioters destroyed property, didn't kill people in political riots. In Baltimore, they started to kill people, and that's when Baltimore began to be known as Mob Town, around 1812.
You write that the Civil War, you say the war began at Fort Sumter, but the killing began in Baltimore.
Yeah. Baltimore tried to, Baltimoreans, especially white Baltimoreans, tried to ignore the coming of the Civil War because they didn't want to talk about the issue of slavery. And in fact, the mayor who was inaugurated just before the beginning of the Civil War said, in his inaugural speech, he said, national politics should have nothing to do with municipal administration. But of course, he learned different just a few months later when mobs of Union troops were pouring through Baltimore on their way to defend Washington. And of course, as we all know, on Pratt Street on April the 19th, 1861, a Baltimore mob attacked a Massachusetts regiment trying to go from President Street Station to Camden Station. 12 civilians were killed, 6 soldiers. Those are the first fatalities of the Civil War right on Pratt Street.
This book is, in a lot of ways, as much about race as it is about politics and institutions and the personalities. And there's a whole plethora of, you know, very quirky, wonderful personalities. Mm-hmm. I was amazed, as I think a lot of folks were, when they picked up the paper on Sunday, the Sun, to find that there's a covenant that's still in place in Rogers Ford.
That's right.
That prohibits black people from living there.
It's not enforceable anymore. It's been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Race has been a sort of constant theme in Baltimore, mostly because Baltimoreans, at least white Baltimoreans, have tried strenuously through almost the entire history of the city not to talk about it, possibly because they're a border city. Whites know that if they make an issue of race, it'll divide whites and unify African Americans. And so they've adopted all sorts of tactics to start tiptoe around the issue. But one time when they did come out in the open has to do with the kind of segregation you're talking about in the case of Rogers Ford. This is before the time of restrictive covenants. In 1910, the Baltimore City Council passed an ordinance that enforced residential segregation. It said that black people could not live on blocks where a majority of the residents were white. White people could not live on blocks where a majority of the residents were black. So it pretended to be even-handed. It was the first law of its kind in the United States, but other cities used it as a model. And the really interesting thing about the ordinance, I can't quote the entire title, it goes on for paragraphs practically. It said that it was a law enacted to keep racial peace, to prevent ill feeling and conflict between the races by keeping them apart. So even when they talked about race, even when they enforced segregation, the purpose was to avoid having conflicts about race.
And it sort of made the argument for the silliness of that, the stupidity of that, in that it was written so poorly, ordinance, that it was interpreted that white people couldn't live in their homes that they owned if there happened to be some black people on the block, and vice versa.
That's right. As a matter of fact, the law, before the Supreme Court ever touched it, the law was thrown out 3 times.
This is the so-called West Amendment.
Right. By the municipal court, and then twice by state courts, until finally it was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1917.
But there are other neighborhoods. I mean, Roland Park has famous covenants about, black people, Jewish people not living there.
Yeah. That's after the ordinance was declared unconstitutional. That's when they went to restrictive covenants, because they hadn't been declared unconstitutional yet. In fact, the mayor of the city sent a booklet from Chicago about how they managed to segregate theirs around to all the real estate companies in Baltimore to instruct them on how to do this.
Matthew Crenson is my guest. His new book is called Baltimore, A Political History. We'll have more with Matt Crenson, and we'll take your calls and comments when we come back from a break. 410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org. If you like to become one of the tens of thousands of people who follow us on Twitter, you can do that at Midday Tom Hall. I think, is that number right, Luke Spicknall? Are we at about 10,000 followers, something like that? So let's get up to 1,000,000 between now and 1 o'clock. All right. At Midday Tom Hall. We'll be right back. Stay with us. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, is it possible to be both fit and fat? There's a movement called Health at Every Size, and we're going to talk about it with our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. That's tomorrow on Midday. Monica will take your calls and questions and comments on this month's edition of Smart Nutrition. Also, this programming note for next month, on Tuesday, October 10th, we're going to be broadcasting Midday live from the Baltimore Museum of Industry, and you are welcome to join us that afternoon at the museum on Key Highway. We'll talk about the deindustrialization of Baltimore and the future of work. Tickets are free, but you'll need a reservation to be part of the audience. Come to wipr.org/midday for a link to the BMI website, and you can reserve a seat. Again, that's Tuesday, October 10th, for a broadcast of Midday live from the Baltimore Museum of Industry. If you've just joined us on this Defenders Day, my guest is the esteemed political scientist and professor emeritus at Johns Hopkins University, Matthew Crenson. We're talking about his new book, Baltimore, A Political History. He's going to be speaking about the book tonight at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road in North Baltimore. You are welcome to join us, 410-662-8780, our email midday at wipr.org. And again, to find us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. Let's go to the phones. Tom in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Matt Crenson.
Yes, good morning to yourself and your guest, Professor Crenson. Sir, in the 1950s, something occurred in Baltimore called blockbusting.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could give an academic analysis of what that was all about and what the residuals are today.
Well, it was about money. Some unscrupulous realtors went around to neighborhoods that were on the boundaries between black Baltimore and white Baltimore. They scared the white residents into selling their houses at ridiculously low prices and getting them to move out, and then sold them to aspiring black homeowners for much higher prices. I should mention I know about this because my father was the victim of a blockbuster and had to sell our house at a severe loss around 1957-58. This was something that happened all over the city, and it was, in a way, an indicator of how white Baltimore handled the issue of race. There's a wonderful book by Edward Orser, who teaches at UMBC, about how Edmondson Village shifted from 20,000 white people to 20,000 black people in the space of less than a decade. And it's interesting, he quotes a black resident of the neighborhood, and she says of the white people who left, they were friendly, but they were prejudiced against black people. They didn't say why they left, they just left. And that's kind of silence, that making prejudice a purely private issue is the way Baltimoreans, I think, have tried to handle race, and blockbusting is one symptom of that. You don't say anything, you just get out.
Tom, thanks for your call. Of course, one of the things that you point out that makes Baltimore unique is that for a long time, Baltimore had the highest concentration, this is pre-Civil mm-hmm. War, of free blacks.
Yeah.
In 1830, there were four times as many free blacks as enslaved blacks here in our city. And by 1860, 92% of the blacks in Baltimore were free. They were not enslaved. Now, white people put up with them. They were a nuisance. Mm-hmm. They were a pain in the neck. But they still, that is one of the things that made our city perhaps different than all the southern cities.
Yeah, it's one of the most distinctive things about Baltimore. It meant that African Americans in Baltimore had the critical mass, the numbers, and the freedom at a very early stage, much earlier than in any other city in the country, to form their own separate institutions, the first of which were all black church congregations. The Sharp Street Methodist Church was organized around 1787. Gives you an idea how far back this goes. And then after Sharp Street, there came other churches, other denominations. There were no public schools for black children in those days, so there were schools until 1867, so there were private schools for black children, philanthropic organizations, social clubs, fraternal organizations, charitable organizations. Black Baltimore was probably one of the best organized black communities in the United States, and that persisted for a long time. In fact, in the 1930s, the local Urban League did a survey of black organizations in Baltimore. They found, among other things, 400 social clubs, which by my calculations comes down to one social club for every 375 African Americans, men, women, and children.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was a mixed blessing. It meant that those organizations had separate constituencies, rival leaders, and so although they're very intensely organized, there are also a lot of divisions within the black community that changed over time, and some of them persist today.
Mm-hmm. And so those divisions sometimes get manifest in political elections. I think of when Martin O'Malley was elected governor, there were three or four black candidates. They sort of split the vote, and he snuck in
and,
behind them.
Yeah, and there was an effort on the part of African-Americans in the city to try to zero in on one candidate, and they just couldn't get people to agree on who the candidate should be.
Matthew Crenson, the book is called Baltimore, A Political History. 410-662-8780 is our number, our email midday@wypr.org to find us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. In 1968, Martin Luther King was killed on the 4th of April. It's a Thursday. Baltimore had its first bit of violence the following Saturday, a couple of days later. Governor Spiro Agnew famously declared a state of emergency, imposed a curfew, deployed the National Guard. I mean, we're thinking about this now in terms of what happened after the death of Freddie Gray. Here's a little bit of what Governor Agnew had to say at the time of the 1968 riots.
We have proclaimed a state of emergency in Baltimore City and Baltimore County. A curfew has been imposed in Baltimore City from 4 p.m. to 6 a.m. and in Baltimore County from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. to those few who loot and burn, we shall show no sympathy, nor will we tolerate those few who would take the law into their own hands.
You write about Agnew had an extraordinary meeting with about 125 African-American leaders in which he did by no means ask for their cooperation, for their help, for their advice, for their good counsel. He berated them.
He blamed them for the riot. He told them that they had not done enough, or they'd done the wrong things. These were people who, many of whom, had been out on the streets for days trying to restore peace. He insulted them. Many of them, in fact, just got up and walked out before he was finished, and the ones who remained remained only to shout back at him. He made some rather dramatic and sensational claims that were not back. He said, for example, that a black radical, Rap Brown, had been in town and he had planned affair. The fact is, he had left town several days before, and he'd been here, according to the accounts that I was able to find, to visit a girlfriend, and he spent all day with her. So yeah. He wasn't conspiring. But he blamed the riot on the entire black community, and it was simply not the case.
One of the points that you make, when we look at statistics, for example, some folks at Harvard figured out that Baltimore ranks today as dead last in the country in the ability of children in poverty to raise themselves out of poverty. And we have about a quarter of our children here in the city who are in poverty. This is particularly the case with boys, young boys. And part of it is the fact that the city is not aligned with the county. I mean, Governor Agnew mentioned, you know, the curfew in Baltimore City and county. So that happened, I guess, they separated officially in 1851. Mm-hmm. But and there's still talk about, you know, regionalization and getting the two jurisdictions together. Why do we have these two jurisdictions, and what has that meant for the city?
Well, originally, I think, the state legislature and the Constitutional Convention of 1850 thought that they were doing a favor for Baltimore County, or the residents outside the city. The city and the county shared facilities. They had a jail, a poorhouse. They shared a courthouse. All of those facilities, especially the jail and the poorhouse, were deteriorating badly. And Baltimore County, if they separate, would have the opportunity to build their own new facilities, which is what they did. They sort of hesitated for a while. They couldn't figure out what to do. At the beginning, the first meeting in Baltimore County to decide about this, couldn't even agree on separating for Baltimore City. But they finally did, and they wound up profiting rather nicely. They had a much lower tax rate, for example, than Baltimore City, which caused many Baltimoreans to move out. That, I think, was the reason. It was never very explicitly articulated. But it's had serious consequences for Baltimore. It means that it has no connection with the resources of the county. means that the county takes no responsibility for the city.
And it's unusual. I mean, I think of places like Atlanta, which is part of Fulton County, right, which is this big, gigantic geographic jurisdiction.
Miami, Indianapolis.
Yeah, Miami-Dade County.
Right. There are only a few cities like this in the United States. And it does change that statistic that you just cited about the placing dead last in social mobility. Since Baltimore is a freestanding city, it doesn't have any suburbs to make it look richer than it actually is. And so it might have been higher if the suburbs had been included. But if you look at Baltimore County in that same study, they rank 61st. So even if you average the two, we're still very far down on the list.
I have an email from Linda who says, I've been complaining publicly for 2 years since Robert E. Lee Park was renamed Roland Park. Roland Park, the neighborhood of exclusivity, was named for an Englishman who found out how to write a covenant keeping Negroes and Jews out of his development. Why is this good? The park should have been renamed for the free black Aquila Scott. Aquila Scott Park, the founder of Bear Hills, a pre-Civil War community for free blacks that still has the black founder's descendants.
Yeah. This, of course, has become a big issue all around the country, lady. We're reconsidering not only our Confederate monuments, but all sorts of monuments. And, of course, the trigger was the disorders in Charlottesville, which unfortunately, I think, identified those Confederate monuments with current white nationalist racism. I agree. We should perhaps reconsider our monuments. I would recommend, instead of tearing them down, putting up monuments to other people like Harriet Tubman or the person mentioned.
In addition to these, what should Baltimore do with the four that they took down?
Put them in a separate place. A museum,
but publicly?
A museum, a little section of a park, so that we can remind ourselves of our past. And not just the things we're proud of, but the things we need to get over. And obviously, as some of your own questions indicate, we still haven't managed to get over our obsession, our problem with our struggle with race.
Absolutely. Let's go to Clarence in New Freedom, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the show, Midday. Clarence, thanks for your call.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. Look, I grew up in Baltimore. I went to school there. Came to Baltimore in 1956, had never went to school with white kids. I came from Salisbury, North Carolina. The riots that took place during Martin Luther King's death, those same neighborhoods with Freddie Gray, those neighborhoods were never fixed up. The school system in Baltimore started to become more and more segregated in the late 70s. And today they're really segregated. And what needs to be done is, one of the things that aren't being talked about between blacks and white, we need to start with slavery, we need to start with redlining, we need to start with all the things that are going wrong that the white population wants to push to the back. Nobody wants to talk about it. And even now with the Justice Department coming in, the white population and the powers to be, they want to keep the black citizens out of what's affecting them. And your guest with his book, it's a good thing, but you need to talk to African Americans in this country. I'm 68 years old. I went through the riots. I lived in Baltimore, lived in 3,000 block of West Lanvale Street, and I saw the burnings and everything like that. But what needs to happen in the city needs to be looked upon. Schaefer, when he was the mayor, and all the mayors that they had, when O'Malley was the mayor, before he became the mayor, he did some things against Bell. And there's a whole bunch of political stuff that has went on.
Sure.
And there's a mistrust of not only the police department, but of the white establishment.
Yeah, well, thanks for the call, Clarence. I mean, you know, Clarence articulates, you know, a long list of things that a lot of people are talking about.
Right, and that's the theme of the book, that they don't talk about it and that they need to, one of the main themes. If we have time, I had the same an experience like Clarence. I grew up here in Baltimore, and I went to a segregated public school. Only mine was a white segregated public school. And the decision in Brown versus the Board of Education came down just about as I was about to graduate from that school. I assumed that since it was the Supreme Court and they were supreme, we'd have integration right away. What I didn't know was that the court had decided to hold the case over for a year to hear argument about how its decision would be implemented. But the Baltimore City Board of School Commissioners, just 17 days after the decision, voted unanimously and with no public discussion to desegregate the schools starting in the next September.
Yeah, actually, and Baltimore was one of the first cities to do that.
Right,
yeah.
But it did so without talking about it.
Right.
And so I went to a modestly desegregated school in September 1954, named after Robert E. Lee.
Yeah, the irony of all of that.
And the remarkable thing, as I looked back on it later, was that while we were there, for attending school with black children for the first time, nobody, no teacher, no administrator ever said anything to us about what was happening.
Yeah.
And later I found out that a memo had gone out, when I did research for the book, a memo had gone out from the school system actually telling the teachers not to make a big deal about this.
One of the things that you write about is the construction of the Baltimore Beltway, completed in 1962, and that's had a very deleterious effect on the economy of the city of Baltimore. In 1977, Mayor Schaefer, who had not been in office all that long, appointed Abel Wolman to lead a task force on population migration,
right,
which is we call white flight.
Right, and the migration occurred most extremely in the 1970s, during the time that Mayor Schaefer was mayor, triggered at first by the riot of 1968, and then later by the declining fortunes of Baltimore and the growing African-American population. And I should mention, in response to the last caller's comments, that it's not just that Baltimore whites and blacks need to talk with one another. Baltimore County whites need to talk to African-Americans in Baltimore. There are a lot who live out there who, in effect, practice segregation, but without ever having to feel or think like racists.
Yeah, I mean, there are lawsuits from HUD having to do with people in Baltimore County being reluctant to have voucher, you know, Section 8 housing near and around where they live. Here's an email from Jeff who says, Annapolis came first, so why did Baltimore grow up to become a huge metropolis while Annapolis stayed a sleepy tidewater town? Even so, why is Annapolis still the capital of Maryland?
Well, actually, Annapolis did its best in the beginning to make sure that Baltimore stayed a sleepy small town. The fact that that Baltimore came along so late, almost 100 years after the first British colonists arrived in Maryland, meant that when Baltimore got started, there was already an entrenched political establishment in Annapolis, and they didn't want Baltimore to have much authority or size. They did a lot to sort of crush the city from the very beginning. So the fact that Baltimore did grow and did prosper is something of a surprise. Annapolis probably remained the way it was because Annapolis didn't have that much going for it economically. Granted, they had a little harbor. Baltimore had a better harbor, an inner and an outer harbor. The outer harbor was really pretty deep. They had a location. They were the westernmost port city on the eastern seaboard. Made it great for them to link the interior of the United States with the Atlantic trade. And they had some industry. Annapolis never developed very much industry. So Baltimore prospered. In fact, between 1790 and 1820, the population of Baltimore quadrupled. It was the fastest growing city.
Yeah, we were a big place back in the day.
We were where it was at.
Yeah.
And but Annapolis was, its business was politics. And it's just stayed there.
It certainly has. That hasn't changed. All right, we're going to take a little break. Matthew Crinson is my guest. His new book is called Baltimore, A Political History. We'll have more, and we'll take your calls and comments. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday. Tom Hall. Here is Miss Simone. Oh, Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the place that many of us call home, Baltimore, as my guest today points out. Can you think of any other one place that could inspire stories as disparate as The Wire, Hairspray, and Diner? How does our history inform the present? Racial inequality continues to be a barrier to economic and social progress. How is that related to the fact, for example, that our city was one of the few places in which both free and enslaved black people lived prior to the Civil War? Matthew Crenson is the author of this new book. It's called Baltimore, A Political History. We welcome your calls and emails and tweets. 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. I want to talk about some of the more current political figures. And I want to start with William Donald Schaefer. There are folks in this town, certainly of a certain age, perhaps in their 60s, 70s, or 80s, who hold Mr. Schaefer as the paradigm of what a mayor should be. I went running this morning in Inner Harbor, and there he is with a statue, with his hand up, looking across the water. You write that he is, quote, a mayor suspended between the old politics of the urban machine and the new politics of municipal bureaucracy. There really does seem to be an inflection point with the election of Schaefer in the late 70s.
Yeah, he was somebody, for example, who could win an award from Citizens Planning and Housing Organization as a good leader, and at the same time be tied up with a local political boss, Irv Covens. So he was right in between there. Very complicated man. It was hard to write about him, to get all of his the elements of his personality into focus. I think the reason why people of a certain age, my age, for example, hold him in such esteem is because he made them feel good about Baltimore for the first time in generations. And he was a booster. He was a cheerleader. He started the city fair, or it started under his administration. And that was a great stimulus to local morale.
Yeah, you called the city fair an assault on the city's inferiority complex.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Because Schaefer was the guy to say, look, folks, this is a great town. We got to love it.
Right.
Yeah. Here's a little bit from a jingle about a campaign that Mr. Schaefer initiated about picking up trash.
Trash ball, I need pay. Everybody wins. Let me show you how to play. Well, when you pick up some trash, then it's a ball, and then you throw it in the bucket, you're playing a trash ball. A jump shot hook, you gotta put it away. We're gonna play that trash ball every day.
I remember the trash ball ads. I've been here since 82. I remember those.
And this is one of the complications about Schaefer. He started the Charm City campaign in the middle of a summertime garbage strike. So it was trash and charm at the same time.
Yeah. And you say that thinking small, which Schaefer did because he was great on constituent service, do it now. He would send these memos to people, fix that pothole, get the stuff right. But it was kind of out of sync with these big projects that actually made his tenure memorable, like the Inner Harbor.
It was, yeah. And in fact, some of his assistants, his staff, who had to live with an awful lot of abuse from him, were nevertheless loyal to him because even though they thought, in fact, I quoted somebody in the book, they thought maybe he didn't understand the details of some of these big projects, but they knew that he was the one person who could carry it off, who could carry it through, because perhaps this booster spirit. And he did achieve such things as Charber Place. But he also relied a lot on neighborhoods. He had, by the time he left office, he had made agreements between the city and 92 neighborhoods to do neighborhood projects. And if he was going to put in a playground, say, he would expect the neighborhood to come up with the money for the swing set. Everybody had to have a piece of the action. And that constituency, in turn, allowed him to control the city bureaucracy much more effectively than many other mayors. From the bottom, but also from the top, he used to have incessant cabinet meetings where his immediate staff would berate bureau heads for mistakes, some of them that Schaefer himself found on his cruises around the city looking for potholes and trash.
When he did these things for all these neighborhoods, though. Did he pay much attention to the African-American neighborhoods? I mean, he's been criticized. Right. For example, a third of the federal urban renewal and community development grants were spent on Harbor Place.
Right.
And at one juncture, a court ruled that that was not even legal.
Right.
There was a lot of opposition to Harbor Place when he dreamed it up back in the day.
The city had to pay a fine because he spent some money that was supposed to go to affordable housing on the Cold Spring project. All of that's true. The mayor, although he was different from previous mayors in his enthusiasm for the city, was part of the tradition, the racial tradition. Back when he was president of the city council, George Russell, the city solicitor, issued an opinion noting that Baltimore's school desegregation plan no longer met federal law. Court cases had come down and federal regulations that made our plan no longer valid. And City Council President Schaefer said, I don't want to talk about that. It'll just raise the race issue. To some extent, he was not a racist. I don't think he could possibly... He lived in a neighborhood that went black, but he and his mother stayed there. And the people in that neighborhood were grateful for him because he did favors for them as a city official. But he did other things. He pretty much neglected the school system. It was a nuisance for him. And in fact, over his administration, the amount of money that the city put into the school system in inflation-adjusted dollars declined by 20%. He wanted to get rid of an African-American school superintendent who was troublesome, who didn't understand Baltimore, Roland Patterson. And he sort of made an agreement with African-American members of the school board, if you'll get rid of this guy, you can have the school system for yourself. And after that, he was just sidelined. Harbor Place was much more important than the schools. And of course, the schools by this time were majority African-American. Mm-hmm. And the city eventually did get into trouble about this, and they managed to, it was only because of some fancy legal footwork that they managed to avoid losing their federal education grants.
Stu in Annapolis, welcome to Midday with Matthew Crenson.
Thank you. I'm calling regarding some of the comments that were made regarding Donald Schaefer, and they say he gets credit for things that he really shouldn't get credit for. The city fair was held despite Schaefer's opposition.
You're right.
It was held primarily because of the efforts of Bob Embry and Hope Quackenbush.
Yep.
Another thing is that Schaefer was a major supporter of the East Expressway, and if he had had his way, much of what he's being given credit for, downtown Harbor Place, Federal Hill, would have been decimated by the expressway. And the only reason the expressway didn't happen was because of the opposition of citizens of Baltimore joining together and fighting it in a unified way, and again, despite the...
Thanks for that call, Stu. That's how Barbara Mikulski made her political mark.
And you're absolutely right, and it's all in the book. He attempted to build an east-west expressway, which would have made it impossible to build Harbor Place. It would have had an interchange hovering over the inner harbor under the original design. And it was only the opposition of a number of citizen groups that prevented the construction of most of it. There is one little piece, sometimes called by Baltimoreans Interstate Zero, that leads to Route 40 and then to nowhere.
But, you know, there certainly can be no denying that Mr. Schaefer's efforts to change people's mindset about the city, at least the white population.
Yeah.
He was successful in that.
He was. Maybe that's why I chose
now, maybe that. No. That certainly isn't enough.
No.
But it was, I'm not sure he changed anybody's mindset in the African-American community. But certainly white people and the power structure, I mean, there was more investment, there was more money flowing into the into the city during his tenure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was, but the city continued to lose population. The school system became increasingly segregated. The highway that the caller just mentioned sucked up millions and millions of dollars in both federal and local money for nothing in the end. So he was, I think, a good ringmaster, but The circus wasn't a success.
Yeah, and you also remind us that when he was term limited out of being the mayor of Baltimore and he ran for governor somewhat reluctantly, he won with 82% of the vote.
The highest percentage in memory, yeah. I think, ever.
And his successors were mostly African-American, with the exception of Martin right. O'Malley. Mm-hmm. Du Burns, who was the president mm-hmm. of the city council when Mayor Schaefer left to run right. for governor, was mayor for a matter of months. He was followed by Kurt Schmoke, then O'Malley, and then Sheila Dixon, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, and our current mayor, Catherine Pugh. Kurt Schmoke, unlike Mr. Schaefer, did take on the schools.
He did.
I mean, he thought very long and hard about the schools, and his mayoralty is not generally considered to have been a big success.
And as a matter of fact, there was a great deal of strife about the schools, mostly because he made personnel decisions, or influenced personnel decisions to be made by the Board of School Commissioners that were not the best. He had one school superintendent who overturned a hard-won fight for school-based management in the city, which the Greater Baltimore Committee, the PTA Council, everybody had agreed on it. He just decided to scrap it, was in contention with his school board the whole time he was here. Also appointed a president of the school board who made decisions on his own hook without consulting the board. So there were a lot of political problems within the school system. Some of them he inherited from Schaefer, of course. But he was not successful. And this is an interesting point, I think, because Schaefer avoided school politics, school policy. And maybe Schmoke proved him right. Maybe he stayed away from the schools because he knew that it would make a mess. It's sad to say, but it's quite possible that he was true
about
that. And
again, the racial dimension of this can't be understated. Bob Embry, who you mentioned, who's right. now running the Able mm-hmm. Foundation and has for many years, was a housing expert and ran mm-hmm. housing for Mr. Schaefer. He thought about running for mayor. He decided not to run against Du Burns yeah. and Kurt mm-hmm. Schmoke, which perhaps would have had Du Burns and Kurt Schmoke split the African American right. vote. And a lot of people think he would have been the mayor had he run.
Well, that's an unresolved question. The polls that they took about the time he was deciding to run showed that he didn't have as much support. But he did decide not to run because, as he said, he didn't like the racial divisiveness of his own candidacy. And it had a remarkable result. Baltimore, like no other city in the country, elected its first black mayor, without making an issue of race, because both of the leading candidates were black.
And then when Mr. Schmoke ran for re-election, he even had like a poster or something that had some African colors in it, and people yeah. accused him of playing the race card.
That's right. Yeah. Another situation where people don't like to talk about race in public. He claimed it didn't have anything to do with race. But
Matthew Crenson, he's a professor emeritus of political science at Johns Hopkins University. The new book is called Baltimore, A Political History. It'll be at the Ivy Bookshop in North Baltimore tonight at 7 o'clock to talk more about the book. We've got a link to the details at wypr.org/midday. Matt Crenson, thanks so much. Good to see you.
Thank you.
That'll do it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle, is back. We'll talk about health at every size. It's a movement that perhaps adduces that it's possible to be fit and fat. That's Midday Smart Nutrition tomorrow right here. I'd like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves cold-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. For the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. Stay tuned. Coming up after a break for the news, it's Here and Now. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.